I have no reason to be sad when this is the life I've chosen for myself. Eventually, I change into my sleeping clothes, brush my teeth, and climb into bed. Lights out. One day done, another soon to begin. But once again, my dreams haunt me. Paul, are you going to tell me what's really going on? Me, I just have work to do. Are you drinking again? No, it has nothing to do with that. Then why all the secrecy, the disappearing act? I told you, I'm looking into something, a friend's missing daughter. What's it to you? Me, hostile. What's it to you? There you go again. I'm trying to ask a question. You make it a war. I'm not making it a war. You keep secrets, Frankie. You enforce boundaries, erect walls, then turn around and try to pretend it doesn't matter. What's it going to take for you to be honest with me? What's it going to take for you to trust me? You're an addict. You really have to ask that. Me, staring at him, feeling my throat thicken and my chest compress. It's not always about drinking. Then what's it about? My mouth opens, but the words don't come out. I stare at his kind, earnest face. I gaze into the eyes of the man who loves me. And once again, I feel nothing but my own frantic heartbeat. I gotta go. I gotta get out. I can't handle this. I found this man. I fell in love with his kindness, his patience. He saw me, all of me, and he didn't turn away. He let me in. He held back my hair while I puked my way through detox. He spoon-fed me broth while I slowly fought my way back to living. He crawled into bed beside me all those horrific nights when I shook uncontrollably and prayed for death, but never actually let go because I didn't want to disappoint him. He is my anchor, the best person I've ever met. If I think of life without him, I feel pain, way down deep in the place that alcohol once took away, and now I will always get to live with. And yet, day after day after day, this life, this existence, I don't feel joy or contentment or everlasting peace. I think, most of the time, don't look at me. Don't look at me. Don't look at me. I think all of the time, I wish I could disappear, vanish without a trace, never to be seen again. My hand on the doorknob, trembling slightly. I'll be back later. Paul, his handsome face now contorted. Don't bother. Okay. It's that easy for you? Just walk away, never look back? For God's sake. I love you, Frankie. Me, twisting the doorknob. Okay. Okay? That's all you have to say? Fucking okay? You break my heart. I love you. I whisper finally, though it's not enough. We both know it's not enough. I so wish I were on the other side of the door. I so wish. Get the fuck out, Frankie. Okay. It's not, he says bitterly. It never was. And me, a stupid broken record. Okay. I leave. He lets me. Okay. 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 And then, mere hours, days, an entire lifetime later, what did you do, Frankie? Dear God, what did you do? Now I'm the one crying. I'm the one cradling his head in my arms. The blood. The blood. The blood. Dear God, the blood. I love you. I love you. I love you. I promise I loved you. But there's just so much blood. As his eyes close and his breath starts to rattle. What did you do? Paul asks me one last time. I loved you. I wake up screaming, Or maybe I'm sobbing. It's hard to be sure which. Piper is curled up against my lower back. I focus on the sound of her rumbling purr as I stare into the dark, willing my breathing to ease, the horror to fade. Paul is gone. Two girls are missing, and I am still me, afraid of everything, of anything. I will find Angelique and Livia, I promise myself, hands fisting the sheets. I will bring them home, I swear it, because I need this, need it. Which explains the phone call I get next. Chapter 24. This is Emmanuel, he says. I'm groggy, still rousing from my troubled night. Emmanuel? I'm here, with my aunt. We need to speak to you. Talk. Now, the victim's family. I can meet you at your apartment. We're outside, at the side entrance. Of course they are. 5 minutes, I mutter, which is a total lie. I'm buried in bed, still wearing my nightshirt, breath foul, feral roommate long gone. I hang up the phone and stagger my way to the shower. I subject myself to an ice-cold spray, then throw on jeans and a long-sleeved shirt and head downstairs before I can think better of it. Angelique's family. They might have new information for me, or new information to demand of me. Either way, their pain matters. I crack open the side door of Stoney's establishment long enough to identify Emmanuel and his aunt. Gerline is wearing traditional turquoise hospital scrubs, but there's something about the expression on her face. I blink against the harshness of daylight, glance at my watch. 10 a.m., late by many standards, way too early for the night shift crowd. I open the heavy metal door wider. Are you hungry? I ask. We've eaten, Gerline speaks up. Coffee? No one says no to coffee. Plus, Lotham had said it was an important part of Haitian hospitality, and I want to be as welcoming as possible. Gerline nods. I allow her and her nephew entrance. Emmanuel, a pro by now, leads the way to the exact same booth he occupied before, while I disappear long enough to activate machines that produce caffeine. My stomach is grumbling. I inspect Viv's fridge, hope she will forgive me as I select two eggs, fire up her griddle, and scramble away. I return with the pot of coffee, pouring out three mugs with the deft practice of a lifelong waitress. Emmanuel goes to work with the cream and sugar. I return to the kitchen, where I wolf down the scrambled eggs to settle my stomach, then give myself a brief and silent pep talk. I head back to the dining room. The police, Gerline says at last, clutching her coffee mug. They ask, but they do not tell. You must have word. I understand. The families so often live in anguished limbo, not trusted, not informed, not represented in their own loved ones' missing persons investigations. I've worked plenty of cases where the suspicions regarding the family's involvement have been borne out, but my gut tells me Emmanuel and his aunt aren't part of that group. Briefly, I tell them about the findings involving Angelique's recovered stash of money, that some of the bills appear to be high-quality counterfeits. Gerline's eyes widen in genuine shock while Emmanuel pauses with his coffee cup in midair. Counterfeit? He asks. Probably printed in Europe and imported.
We don't have counterfeit money, Gerline says. We don't have money.
And yet, Angelique had. Did Angelique ever talk about her friend from the summer camp, Livia Somdi? Twin knows. Do you know Livia? More head shakes. Ever hear her name mentioned? Maybe when Angelique was talking to another one of her friends, or maybe you came home early to find a new girl visiting your apartment? Gerline shakes her head, more emphatically this time. Emmanuel hesitates. One day, I overheard Lily on the phone.
She was trying to calm someone down. I know, she kept repeating. Then, I'm working on it. Please trust me. And? I prod. And then Angelique spotted me. She turned away, ended the call. It was only later that it occurred to me. The way she was holding the phone, it wasn't right.
What do you mean?
Her iPhone is flat, like everyone else's. This phone, the way she had her hand wrapped around it, it had to be smaller, thicker, like a flip phone.
An after-hours phone, I fill in.
What is an after-hours phone? Gerline asks. Like a burner phone. We suspected Angelique had a second phone, hence she left her original phone in her backpack.
Completing her disguise as Livia, I think,
while also eliminating the chance her personal cell would be discovered on her or used to trace her movements. Are you sure she wasn't speaking to one of her other friends, Marjorie or Kira? I say to Emmanuel.
I don't think so.
Her tone? He shrugs. When she saw me, she looked guilty. Why would she feel guilty about talking to her friends?
Emmanuel is an astute young man. I'm willing to bet he's right. Angelique was speaking on a burner phone with Livia, and once again, I'm struck by her level of secrecy regarding that relationship. But I don't think now is the time to go into that level of detail with Angelique's family. I don't think Angelique was trying to run away or disappear, I say at last. It sounds like she had befriended a girl, Livia, from the summer rec program. Livia's own background, let's just say it appears she was in some kind of trouble, and Angelique was trying to help her. So much so, Angelique was dressed as Livia that final afternoon in November. That's why the police originally couldn't find evidence of Angelique departing her school. She did it disguised as Livia Samdi. Gerline's eyes widen. She clearly doesn't know what to say. Beside her, Emmanuel appears equally shocked.
What does this Livia girl have to say for herself? Gerline asks at last.
She also went missing. A few months later, except her family never reported it, which is why the police didn't make the connection. The family assumed the girl had run away.
This girl is trouble?
I don't know. But her brother is a known drug dealer.
My Angelique did not do drugs.
I hold up a placating hand. No one is saying she did. For that matter, there's no evidence Livia did drugs either. Like Angelique, Livia was a gifted student, except her talents were in computer design and 3D printing. Gerline appears even more lost. Emmanuel recovers first.
Lily was smart, and she could draw, but like freehand. I never saw her do anything on a computer.
This girl with the drug family, says Gerline. Could the fake money be hers? Because my Angelique... Children make mistakes, yes, but she is a good girl. That kind of money only comes from bad things, and Lily is not that kind of bad.
Now it's my turn to feel stupid. When we'd found the money, we hadn't known about Livia yet. But in retrospect, it does seem more probable that the money came from Livia or her drug-dealing brother. Maybe Angelique was keeping it safe for her. Or as a safety net. That kind of money, thousands of dollars, would definitely be something Johnson, fine, JJ, would want back. But more to the point, the fake hundreds? Had Angelique and Livia realized they were counterfeit? Two intelligent girls, both known for their attention to detail? Had Livia realized her brother had gotten himself into something much more dangerous than street corner distribution? She could have stolen the money, asked her friend Angelique to hold it for her, or... My mind is starting to spin. I feel like I suddenly have too much information to work with, except, again, how to make sense of it all. I rest my elbows on the table
peering hard at Gerline and Emmanuel. Anything else you might have heard or remember from the time leading up to Angelique's disappearance? The smallest little thing that maybe didn't seem like a big deal at the time, but now, looking back? Snippets of conversation? Email? Hurried exchanges? Odd behavior?
She was quiet, Emmanuel volunteers at last. I found her one day, curled up on the sofa, just sitting. No TV, phone. When I asked, she said she was tired. Another afternoon?
He hesitates, ducks his head. Speak, Gerline demands.
She was holding the picture of our mom. She'd taken it down and was staring at it. She looked sad, very sad. When she saw me, she put it back. Clearly, she'd been crying. I assumed she was feeling homesick. Sometimes I am homesick too, and I don't even remember home anymore.
Aunt Gerline reaches over and takes her nephew's hand. When was this? I ask.
I don't know. We were back in school. Fall sometime.
I nod. I'd already inspected the framed photo during my first search of their apartment, seen the love letter tucked behind the faded picture. Neither child had seen their mother in nearly a decade, but clearly they still yearned for her. Maybe enough that whatever was going on in Angelique's life, she didn't feel she could tell her aunt, so had sought comfort from her mother's photo instead. I take a deep breath. 2 mornings ago, Angelique was spotted at a wireless store in Mattapan Square. Gerline gasps, then appears outraged, Emmanuel as well. This little disclosure is going to get me into a truckload of trouble with Lotham, but I feel it's necessary. As she was walking away, she dropped a fake ID. They're studying it now. I think you should look at it too. I point my chin at Emmanuel. In case she used some kind of code again, you know her best. Emmanuel nods immediately. Despite his young age, he's serious, even solemn. In this moment, I see shades of the older sister he described to me. Problem solvers, doers. Life hasn't always been kind to them, but it's made them stronger, more determined. Opportunity isn't given, it must be made. Which makes me wonder again what Angelique had been up to. Helping a friend made sense and explained the stash of money as well as her deception, dressing up as Livia to head for some mysterious meeting that Friday. But what had happened next to keep Angelique away from home permanently, while still not being enough to save her friend, who'd disappeared 3 months later? I think back to what Charlie had said. If they were being held against their will, but still alive, then they must have value. But what kind of value did 2 15-year-old girls have? Beyond the obvious, of course, in the sex trade. I felt like it had to have something to do with the counterfeit money, which was our other outlier. Maybe their captors knew the girls had fake hundreds, wanted them to fetch more, make more? Except that was a pretty tall order, given it took highly skilled experts to pull off quality bills. My mind spins through possibilities, but none of them make sense. Livia is the key to understanding what happened in the past, I decide now. She's the missing girl no one even knew was missing, and yet was probably also the original target. Which leaves us with Angelique, given her recent appearances, as the best hope for finding both girls in the future, before time runs out. With that in mind, I finally organize some semblance of next steps. I'm going to call Detective Lotham, I announce, rising from the booth. Ask him to bring over Angelique's fake license. Emmanuel, you stay here to study it. I hesitate, glance at Gerline. I must make some calls, she volunteers. Return to work. I can come back. It's not a problem. Emmanuel will contact you when we're done. I imagine she doesn't get many vacation days, and after the events of the past year, she probably can't afford to take any more.
Gerlene climbs out of the booth and heads for the door. I step away from the table to call Lotham.
I update him on the morning's developments, then hold my phone far from my ear as the yelling begins.
Chapter 25. Lotham seems over the worst of his tantrum by the time he arrives at Stoney's. He skewers me with a single glare when I let him in, then stalks over to the booth where Emmanuel remains seated. I've made a second pot of coffee. Wordlessly, I pour out a mug for Lotham. I take a seat next to Emmanuel while Lotham slides in across from us. Lotham removes a clear plastic bag from the inside of his charcoal gray sports jacket. A thick stripe of red tape screams evidence across the top. Lotham doesn't open the bag, but sets it on the table. I scan the bag's contents. A single Massachusetts driver's license. I remember Emmanuel and me studying the black and white photocopy of this same license, used by Angelique at the Cyber Cafe, days ago. The real thing is much more distinct and will hopefully provide better details.
No opening the bag, no touching the license, no removing it from my sight,
Lotham states. The rules of engagement, which are important for preserving the chain of custody. Emmanuel nods. His young face is once again deadly serious as he picks up the bag, peers at the front of the ID, then flips it over to study the back. The picture is of a young African-American female, black hair scraped back from her face in a tight ponytail, dark brows, dark eyes, full face. Much more heavily made up than I would have imagined, while huge beaded earrings provide further distraction. Mostly, I notice her eyes. They don't gaze ahead with the deer-in-headlights stare of so many official IDs, but seem to peer straight into the viewer. They radiate intelligence.
This is my sister, Emmanuel confirms, but I've never seen her with this jewelry, and Lily hardly ever wore makeup. It's her, but different.
We see that often in fakes, Lotham says. Tricks for making the subject appear older, or to obscure her real features. On this license, Angelique is supposed to be Tamara Levesque, age 21.
Emmanuel cocks his head to the side.
She used this license to post her class essay. But why Tamara Levesque? That name means nothing to me.
Do you know how to check an ID to tell if it's fake?
Lotham asks him presently.
No, sir.
This is modeled after the current Massachusetts driver's license, which involves a fairly sophisticated design. Not as high-tech as the real IDs now required for airport security, but still no joke. So, here's what to look for. First off, feel the weight of it. Genuine licenses are high quality, decent weight, nearly impossible to bend. Try it.
Emmanuel fingers the license through the plastic bag. Experimentally, he squeezes the ends together. Nothing.
In other words,
Lotham continues,
the initial structure is solid. That's some skill right there. Now run your finger along the printing. Should be slightly raised. It's a specialized laser technique.
Emmanuel frowns.
I can't feel it well enough through the bag.
Then trust me to tell you, they got that right too.
Which brings us to the more difficult elements. You see the watermark of the golden dome from the state house? Then we get to the embedded image of the state bird and state flower. Peering from across the table, I interject.
Wait, is that the brown blob in the middle? I thought that was a dragon.
It's a chickadee.
Huh. Lotham gives me a look.
The hologram is off. Not a true hologram if you hold it up to the light. Instead, they've created a visual illusion done with particularly bright inks. I've seen this approach before. Also, under blue light, several things should appear on a real license. But the producers substituted reflective dyes for the proper UV ink in this model. All in all, I'd consider this a drinking class license, so to speak, not flying class.
Emmanuel nods.
Now, this is the part that's interesting. Final significant feature, the barcode. Upon scanning, it should verify the info already shown on the licenses. Plenty of fakes show a barcode, but it's nothing but garbage. This barcode is genuine, which is a decent accomplishment. Whoever made this put a lot of care and technology into it. A few more iterations and maybe flying class would be within reach.
Emmanuel nods. I'm desperate to get my hands on the piece, but Emmanuel still clutching the ID in a way that speaks of more than an academic interest. This is the last thing his sister touched. One more tiny link to her. He's not going to set it down anytime soon.
Which brings us to the information on the ID itself. Lotham states, name, address, date of birth. Best practice is to keep the user's day and month of birth, just change the year. That way, when a suspicious bouncer asks questions, the holder can rattle off the correct answer off the top of his or her head. Knowing your sister's info, I can already tell you that's not true. Look, does the date of birth mean anything to you? Code? Another cry for help? Something?
Emmanuel's eyes widen.
That is our mother's birthday, he blurts out. But why? As you say, just changing the year would be easier.
I was hoping you could tell me.
But Emmanuel doesn't have an answer.
Okay, next few lines. Height, weight, eye color. Anything jump out at you?
The address.
Emmanuel speaks up shortly, his voice excited again.
P.O. Box 1804.
That's too short to be a valid box number around here,
Lotham provides.
It is an important date for us in Haiti, the year of our independence.
I frown at the revelation. Another inside joke on Angelique's part? But to what end?
There's a physical address as well,
Lotham says.
Check it out.
Emmanuel studies the print.
I don't know this address.
Because it's not valid. At a real DMV, the system wouldn't even accept it. That street doesn't exist in all of Boston, let alone Mattapan.
Can I show my aunt?
For chain of custody purposes, this can't leave my sight, but you could write down the info. Now, I need you to study the license number itself. Normally, the string of numbers communicates information to law enforcement. Yet another point of verification. Trust when I say, this license number is nothing but a string of gibberish, which doesn't make sense. They get the barcode right, only to screw up the license number? Which makes me wonder, could this be another code meant for you?
Emmanuel scrunches up his face. His lips move as he reads off the numbers to himself. Then repeats several times. Slowly, he shakes his head.
This is not obvious to me, but Lily had several ciphers. If I could compare these numbers with her notes in her code-breaking book, I might be able to figure it out.
Add it to your address notes.
Lotham produces a scrap of paper, pushes it across the table. Emmanuel gets to work. Emmanuel, I speak up. Is there something from Haiti that might be relevant? A reference to a belief, religion, custom? I don't know. But the fact that Angelique chose your mother's date of birth, as well as a mailing address that marks your country's independence, surely that's not accidental.
Emmanuel smiles slightly.
You mean, like pointing at a rainbow brings bad luck, or eating the top of a watermelon will cause your mother to die? There are many superstitions in our culture, most of which my sister and I have heard from our aunt. But for us, Lily believed in science, and I've lived my life here, not there. These are stories to us, nothing more.
It's not personal to Angelique, I fill in. At least not personal enough. Emmanuel nods. He fingers the evidence bag, then sets it down.
I can study the license number, the street address. For now, all I can say is that Lily must be thinking of our mother.
Lotham exhales, tries not to look as frustrated as I'm sure he must feel.
I turn to him.
You're saying this is a decent quality ID, possible to produce with a computer and printer, but requires some advanced skill.
So, how did Angelique get her hands on it?
Probably bought it on the streets. This area has some known providers. Wouldn't be too hard to ask around. Make it happen.
You think? Because this is a girl who takes extra high school courses in her free time. She's not exactly lurking on street corners.
Emmanuel suddenly flushes.
Emmanuel?
Lotham's voice holds a low growl of warning.
Other kids in high school, the rec center, they speak of fake licenses.
Purchased from the internet, I say. At least that's what I'd heard from Charlie.
Maybe some, but...
That awkward teen pause again.
Who, Emmanuel?
Lotham demands. The kid relents with a sigh.
Marjolie, Angelique's best friend. She has a fake ID. I heard her talking about it one day with Lily. She was bragging about getting into a club. When Lily asked her how, Marjolie started giggling. I couldn't hear her answer, but Marjolie has a fake license, and she definitely could have gotten one for my sister. Once, I would have said my sister didn't have the money to waste on such things. But after what you found in the lamp.
Emmanuel looks at me.
I must accept I didn't know everything about my sister. I must wonder. Maybe I didn't know her at all.
You did, Emmanuel. You know her, and she's counting on that. The coded school essay, the particulars of this license, your sister is out there. And she's talking to you. She's counting on you. But I can tell the kid doesn't believe. And after all the cases I've been through, I can't really argue. I clear the coffee mugs and carry them to the kitchen. I already know where we're going next. Chapter 26. 30 minutes later, I stand across from Angelique's high school, waiting for the bell to ring. Having spent hours yesterday staring at the same view through the corner grocer's security camera, it feels like I've known this place forever, instead of just a single afternoon. Lotham had wanted to march into Boston Academy, gold shield flashing, and drag Marjolie straight down to the station for questioning. Fortunately, cooler heads had prevailed. Now, I have the honor of meeting up with Marjolie and coaxing her back to Lotham's vehicle, parked several blocks away, where we can all chat privately. I'm due for work sooner versus later, so I need this to go quick and easy. No pressure. I hear the bell start its run. There is a roughly 5-minute delay, then the front doors of the academy heave open and the first wave of students pour out, hefting their packs and bolting to freedom. A couple of minutes later, Marjolie appears, head bent close to Kira's as they descend the front steps deep in conversation. Once again, I'm struck by the contrast between the two. Kira, tall and stunning, even from this distance, while Marjolie walks with her shoulders hunched self-consciously. Pretty, to Kira's drop-dead gorgeous. Softer, to Kira's hard-edged attitude. One leader, one follower. I feel the first prickling of unease just as Marjolie glances up and spots me. Across the street, rows of traffic and rivers of kids between us, she falters. So many expressions flicker across her face. Shame, fear, regret, guilt. A whole boatload of guilt. She knows that I'm here for her, that finally this is all about her and that stupid summer program at the rec center and all the secrets teenagers feel the need to keep. She turns away from her friend, already debating her options,
I lean forward, preparing to give chase. Then Kira spies me. She grabs her friend's arm, totally missing the nuances. She tugs Marjali forward, and after a final tense moment, the shorter girl gives way. She lets Kira guide her across the street to me. This is it. 11 months later, it's finally time for the truth. I have some questions for Marjali involving the summer program she attended with Angelique at the rec center. I keep my voice light, tone matter-of-fact, as I rattle off the story Lotham and I had concocted to justify culling Marjali from the herd. Okay. Marjali stares down at her feet, her fists tightly clenched around the straps of her backpack. What do you want to know? Kira prods. I think it would be better if we spoke alone. Don't you agree, Marjali? The shorter girl still won't look at me, while beside her, Kira blinks in confusion. Why do you want to know about summer camp? Did you learn something more about Angel? Kira leans forward eagerly. Tell us. We're her friends. We deserve answers. I keep my gaze on Marjali. Fashion camp. You and Angelique signed up together? The girl nods. And there was this other girl, Livia Somdi, also in the class, prone to wearing a red baseball cap? A look of pure misery sweeping across Marjali's face. Yes. Come with me, I say gently. It won't take long. I just have a few questions. Nothing special. I glance at Kira while Marjali nods. I'll catch up with you later, she tells her friend. Kira isn't stupid. She looks from Marjali to me to Marjali. I'll go with you. No. Marjali, tone sharp, eyes wild. Marjali. Kira, her voice pleading. She's scared, I realize. But not about what she knows, but about what she's now realizing she doesn't know. And she's worried for her friend. I'm sorry, Marjali whispers, but I can tell Kira still doesn't know who or what her friend's apologizing for. She'll call you later, I intervene. Then I place my hand on Marjali's shoulder and guide her away before Kira can continue pressing the issue. Kira lets us go. I can feel Marjali shaking beneath my touch as I lead her down the first block, then the second. We walk in total silence, tension building. Lotham has his tricks, I have mine. Around the corner, to the unmarked car. I pop open the back door, just as Marjali's head snaps up. I didn't mean it, she exclaims wildly. I swear, I didn't mean to hurt her. I had no idea. Then she bursts into tears. You're welcome, I tell Lotham, as Marjali collapses in the back seat and the show officially begins. It comes out in fits, starting with a boy, because so many stories do. The basketball player, the one Marjali followed to the rec center because she needed to protect her territory. Lotham and I sit in the front seat of the car, Marjali in the back. Forget driving to the station. Our target is already pouring out her sins. We don't have time for traffic. Lotham has his phone on, discreetly recording away. He's looking at anything but the sobbing girl in the back seat, so I continue to do the honors. You convinced Angelique to sign up with you, your wingman, or woman in this case. She wanted to work. Earn extra money babysitting, but I begged and pleaded. That was the thing with Angel. She'd do anything for her friends, and we'd been best friends since fifth grade. So you and her signed up for fashion camp, except it was never about fashion camp.
Dommy J,
Marjali sighs, sobs. Heartbreaker? I ask.
I thought he loved me. I thought I should have known better.
Poor girl. I don't think she could look any more miserable. How old's Dommy J? I ask.
17.
to Marjolie's then 15.
Hot?
Lotham gives me a look, but I stand by my question.
Totally. All the girls wanted him, but he chose me. He said he liked my smile.
I nod sympathetically. I already know where this story's going, and I feel terrible for Marjolie. For all the vulnerable, self-conscious girls out there who dared to believe the cool guy wanted them, when really? What happened, Marjolie? You met Dommy J, convinced Angelique to sign up for fashion camp, and then...
Angel didn't like him. She warned me. Worse?
Marjolie smiles bitterly.
She told me I could do better. But of course, who could do better than him? I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to believe.
Marjolie presses her lips together. More tears slide down her cheek. I whack Lotham till he belatedly produces a travel pack of tissues.
Dommy's older, you know. He's not the type to be sitting around at home at night. Plus, he has all these college friends, hoops players who know the hot spots.
I nod.
During the day, at camp, he was really sweet. He'd call me his girl, walk around with his arm around me. He made me feel special. I'm not gorgeous like Kira or smart like Angel. I'm just me.
Marjolie shrugs.
Except when Dommy was around. Then I was the girl other girls stared at. I was the one everyone else wanted to be. So when he said he wanted to go club hopping and I should go with him, of course I'm gonna go. Him, out on the town with his buddies in places like that? No way he's going home alone.
But you were only 15, I prod gently. Marjolie's chin comes up.
I can rock it. Little more makeup, right hair and clothes. I just need an ID to back it up. And that's okay, because Dommy J knows this guy. $50 for a fake. Nights out with my man? Priceless.
Her lips twist sardonically. She starts dabbing at her smeared mascara.
I didn't tell Angel, not at first. I knew she wouldn't approve. And she was mad at me. I'd made her sign up for a fashion camp, and then Dommy J's breaks were different than ours, and I kept sneaking out to see him. She said I'd abandoned her. I didn't mean it that way. Just, I was the girl making out with a hot guy in the hallway, you know? I'd never been that girl before.
How'd you get the fake ID, Marjolie?
Dommy got it. I gave him the money on Tuesday. He brought me the ID Thursday. That night, we're at his favorite club, hitting the dance floor with all his friends. He's got moves, I got moves, he's buying me shots. Everyone's happy.
She hesitates, voice dropping low.
I felt like I was flying, like it was the best night of my life, like it would never get better than this. Then, Dommy J took me out to his friend's car.
She pauses. Her expression goes flat. Did he rape you, Marjolie? I asked the question. Lotham's jaw has set, his hands fisting.
Nothing like that. I gave it up. I thought, this is what I'd been waiting for. I thought this was the special fucking moment with that special fucking guy.
She laughs now, but it's a harsh sound.
The next day at the rec center, I tell Dommy I love him. I tell him I can't wait to go out again. Have fake license, we'll travel, you know? Dommy says I should bring a friend. It's awkward, him with me, then all the guys. He says maybe I could bring Kira.
Marjolie's drop-dead gorgeous friend. Of course.
Oh, honey, I'm so sorry.
Marjolie doesn't cry anymore. She is too gutted for tears. She's right. First love feels like flying higher than the sun. and inevitably leads to the mother of all crash landings.
I asked Angel instead. I didn't want to believe.
Marjorie glances up at me.
I thought if I brought Angel, that would be good enough.
You asked Angelique to come with you club hopping?
Lotham is startled enough to finally ask a question.
I showed her the ID. What's the big deal? Even if she didn't love partying, this is the girl who never stops talking college. She could use her fake license to sneak onto campus, take classes, whatever. It'd be good. I begged her, but she was angry. So then I told her everything. What Dami and me did, how much I loved him, how much I needed her to do this because I couldn't bring Kira, obviously. And I didn't want it to end.
What did Angelique say?
Lotham again.
She didn't. She just grew quiet. Then she hugged me, like, really tight. And I started to cry because I knew. I just didn't want to know.
Marjorie closes her eyes, takes a big, shuddery breath. Turns out, Dami J's a collector. V-cards. Like, is even in a competition with his buddies over who has the most. And having gotten mine, he broke up with me 2 days later. Clubbing, dancing, true love. None of it meant a thing. Oh, honey, I say again. That's when things got weird.
Lotham frowns, gives me a look as he twists back around in the driver's seat. Weird how?
Next week, bright sunny day, everyone's sitting outside. Angel walks right up to Dami J. At first, you can't really hear them. She's like whispering furiously. He's totally blowing her off, even giving me dirty looks like this is all my fault. Then she suddenly raises her voice. She starts talking in as loud a voice as possible, that he's a cheat, that the fake IDs he sells aren't even worth the plastic they're printed on.
She has our full attention now.
I had showed her mine to convince her to buy her own, but now she's yelling that $50 is a total ripoff. A mall cop could tell they were fake, and Dami J's gonna get all his friends arrested. Then she says, super loud, he owes everyone a refund.
A refund?
Lotham presses. Marjorie nods solemnly.
Dami J was furious. She doesn't know what she's talking about. Take her fucking mouth and get out of his fucking way. Which is when the other girl,
Livia Somdi.
Yeah, totally quiet, like never speaks at all. Everyone knows her older brother got kicked out of the program 2 years ago for drugs. JJ, something like that.
Johnson.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
She suddenly joins Angel, yelling at Dami. Except she knows all this stuff. The fakes Dami J is dealing don't have the right hologram, laser printing, I don't know, all sorts of shit. Basically, she's also insisting Dami J has cheated all his friends. Now, everyone's listening and things are getting really intense. I mean, Dami's got all his buds there. Who knows how many fakes he sold them?
Do you know how many fake licenses he sold?
Lotham pushes. Marjorie shakes her head.
What about the others being involved? Some of his friends also selling the IDs?
I just know Dami, and he doesn't make them. At least, I don't think he does. He said a friend did. But when we were at the nightclub, all his buddies were using them. It's not like they're 21.
At $50 a pop, Lotham and I exchange another glance.
Do you have your license on you?
I ask. Marjorie hesitates, as if finally remembering she's talking to cops.
Lotham arches a brow.
She relents, digging into her pack until she finds her wallet, then produces the ID.
She hands it to Lotham first, who tests the weight of it in his hands, then twists it around in the light. He doesn't say a word, just passes it to me. Marjolee has been telling the truth. It's cheap work. Too thin, blurry photo, not even an attempt at the holograph. In comparison, the fake license Angelique dropped the other day is a masterpiece. $50 for this? I see Angelique's point. So Angelique and Livia accuse Dommy J of ripping off his friends, I prod, in front of everyone. Angel's trying to get back at him for what he did to me. The other girl, Livia, I don't know what her deal is. But this stuff, Dommy J, the crowd he hangs with, it's no joke. Angelique shouldn't have been talking to him like that, especially in front of others. Dommy gets real serious, real fast. He shoves them back, tells them to shut the fuck up, or they'd be sorry.
He threatens them?
Lotham, clarifying. I guess.
And then?
Marjolee shrugs. The director guy came out, Mr. Lagudu. Breaks over, everyone back inside. Angel was still shaking, really upset. I knew she'd done it only for me, but I told her to knock it off. She was going to get herself in trouble. And I was embarrassed. Maybe I hoped Dommy J might still change his mind, take me back. But after that little display, Marjolee exhaled roughly. Angel and me had some words. Big fight, really. Angel, she couldn't see it. Sometimes she was too smart, too capable. She didn't understand what it meant to be just a regular girl like me. She didn't understand that sometimes her being her just made me feel bad. Marjolee swallows, falls silent. Things weren't the same between us after that. She kept sitting with the Livia girl. Sometimes I swore they were whispering about me. I wanted to apologize, make things right. I hurt too, you know. I loved this guy. Then he'd gone and done, I don't know. Summer camp really sucked. When it ended and school started again, things settled. Livia was gone, and it was the Angel, Kira, and Marjolee show again. I figured more time would pass. We'd grow close again, like we used to be. Except then one day, Angel was just gone, and we never got our second chance. Did you see her with Livia Somdi again? After the summer program? I ask. She shakes her head.
What about Dommy J?
Lotham presses.
Any more altercations between those two?
Not between Angel and him.
But between?
Marjolee took a deep breath. The last week of the summer program. I'm just leaving when I see Dommy J at the street corner. So I slow down, cause I'm stupid, that's why. Then I see Livia in her red baseball cap. She's standing right in front of him, but she's not the one yelling this time. He's clearly pissed off, ranting away, and she's like cowering, trying to just weather the storm. Then he grabs her. I'm startled. I've never seen him get physical with a girl before. Suddenly, she gets this look. She plants her feet and stares right at him. She says loudly, "You know who my brother is, don't you?" He says he doesn't give a flying fuck about JJ, which makes her shake her head. "Not JJ," she says. "My other brother."
"Her other brother?"
Lotham asks sharply. "Exactly." She glances across the street. That's when I see him. Some super tall dude in a blue tracksuit and gold chains. He didn't look all that scary to me. But Dommy now? His reaction?
Dommy J drops Livia's arm and backpedals so fast, I thought he was going to trip over his own damn feet.
He saw this guy across the street and he ran away?
Me this time, because I'm suddenly remembering my first visit to the school, the guy I spotted watching me, and possibly spied standing outside the Somdi residence before bullets started to fly.
Dommy J looked like he was gonna shit his pants. I've never seen him look that scared.
Lotham stares at Marjorie.
What did Livia do?
That's the thing. Second Dom let her go, she scampered off, but not toward the dude, in the total opposite direction. I saw her face right before she took off down the sidewalk. I swear, she looked just as scared as Dommy. I mean, if this guy is her brother, why is she so freaking anxious to get away from him?
Chapter 27. 3 p.m. We pull away from the curb and head once more into Mattapan. I'm going to be late for work, but with a little bit of traffic luck, hopefully not too late. I'm agitated. The thought of spending the next 8 hours serving drinks and wiping down tables when I have so many questions regarding Angelique and Livia right now. When I feel we're so close to learning the truth right now. Alcoholics are notoriously obsessive, particularly involving something as stimulating as right now. What do you make of Marjorie's fake ID? I ask Lotham, my fingertips thrumming restlessly on my knee.
Definitely cheap. Surprised it got them into any kind of nightclub. Then again, some places slip a little cash into the bouncer's hand and the deal is done. They just want plausible deniability if things go sideways.
Angelique's ID is definitely better quality than the one Marjorie had.
Significant step up.
I purse my lips, angling myself in the passenger seat to better face him. Isn't that kind of interesting, that she complains to this Dommy J about the quality of his work?
About the way he treated her friend.
And a year later, Angelique herself is running around with a superior fake. Lotham nods thoughtfully. We've come to a red light. He glances over at me, his face hard to read.
You think Angelique made that license? Or helped someone make it?
I think if Marjorie's story is true, Livia Somdi knows a lot about fake IDs, while also having the skills to do better. $50 a pop. I mean, if Dommy J can unload hundreds of dollars worth of shitty IDs during a summer rec program, imagine how much Livia could make off quality merchandise.
Of all the counterfeiting we've discussed, a fake ID is the most feasible DIY project. With the right software and a specialized printer, I could see two teenage girls pulling it off.
Lotham frowns.
Unfortunately.
Maybe the money in Angelique's lamp came from their own business enterprise. Livia probably enjoyed the design challenge, while Angelique had personal incentive to run Dommy J out of business.
Why the counterfeit hundreds?
Lotham countered, making a hard right into a stalled stream of city traffic. Maybe someone paid them with fakes. Maybe they didn't know they even had counterfeit bills.
So they're smart enough to see the flaws in fake IDs but not forged bills?
He raises a valid point. But damned if I can figure out how we get from Russian-printed Ben Franklins to locally manufactured fake driver's licenses. I'm also curious that the executive director of the rec center, Frederic Lagoudou, never mentioned a huge confrontation between Angelique and Livia and this Dommy J. Unless he came upon it at the very end and had just enough time to break it up while writing it off as another day in paradise. Because surely, once Angelique went missing, her screaming match with a wannabe hoodlum would be worth noting.
Let's say Livia Somdi knows something about production, given her design talents.
Lotham muses.
After the confrontation with Dommy J, she and her new bestie Angelique start scheming. They'll make their own fake IDs, superior quality, that will drive dumbass Dommy out of business while earning them extra cash.
Livia is manufacturing, Angelique marketing and sales.
Lotham nods.
Cars are not moving. He gives it another 10 seconds, then flashes his grill lights. The car in front of us does its best to squeeze over.
Lotham threads through a narrow opening between the clogged lanes, gets to the first turnoff, and takes it.
I have no idea where we are, but I like his style.
Here's what I don't get,
Lotham says.
Wouldn't Angelique's first customers be your own friends? Think of the Dommy J model. He probably signed up for the summer program just so he could sell to his fellow teens. Enter Angelique, who we're saying sold enough to have thousands in cash but never approached her own social circle. That seems odd.
I sit back grumpily. Then, remembering my conversation with Charlie. Maybe she and Livia sold online. The international IDs are done that way. And these are two girls who've both been described as quiet. Internet sales would work while further compartmentalizing this new criminal activity from their real college aspirational lives.
Possible. But that introduces more infrastructure. How are they getting paid? Money transfers? Bitcoin? They'd need to have bank accounts and they're both underage.
Not according to Angelique's fake alter ego, Tamara Levesque.
Lotham's eyes widen slightly.
Shit.
He bangs the steering wheel with his hand.
Of course. We examined the Levesque ID for forensic clues, then overanalyzed it with the help of Angelique's brother for coded messages. Maybe, all along, the breadcrumb was the name itself. Tamara Levesque. A lead on Angelique's secret life, which has clearly gotten her and her friend in trouble.
Oh, I finally get it. As in, Angelique doesn't have bank accounts and Livia Somdi doesn't have financial records, but Tamara Levesque? Oh.
Damn sleep deprivation,
Lotham mutters.
I'll get on it the second after I drop you off.
I sigh heavily. So much happening right now. On the cusp of so many answers right now.
We still have a problem,
Lotham says, finally able to pick up a little speed as he cuts through a maze of tiny side streets.
Assuming Livia and Angelique were doing this together, why did Angelique go missing first?
She was posing as Livia, trying to protect her from someone.
And it took that someone 3 months to realize he had the wrong girl? That's not a very bright someone. Besides, if you're a criminal who wants to move in on their new and improved fake ID business, wouldn't you just grab both of them?
I have to think about it. If Livia is the design genius behind their operation, then she'd be more valuable than Angelique. Maybe that's why she appeared so scared. Maybe Angelique volunteered to take the meeting in Livia's place. When the bad person discovered the subterfuge, they kept Angelique and used her as leverage to force Livia to work for them.
Then why take Livia 3 months later?
Coercion only works so long, or operations had grown so fast they needed Livia at their immediate disposal? Maybe they have Livia shut up somewhere, designing a million fake IDs a day, I don't know. And Livia's now the collateral being held against Angelique. Hence, Angelique has resurfaced to perform other smaller tasks, because as long as they have Livia, they know she'll return to them.
There's a lot of assumptions in that theory,
Lotham informs me.
On the other hand, playing the girls off each other is a tried and true strategy, used by human traffickers everywhere. In fact, it's often easier to kidnap two people rather than just one, as it gives the kidnapper more leverage over both of them.
Those poor girls, I murmur. For Angelique, this whole thing probably started as a way to strike back against the asshat that hurt her bestie. For Livia, maybe it was all about impressing her new friend, inserting herself deeper into Angelique's world. and for their troubles, the two of them have now been kidnapped, while most likely being forced to engage in some kind of criminal activity, license forgeries, something. I don't know if I could handle that kind of stress, especially 11 months later. Lotham nods, arrives at last by the side door of Stoney's.
So, to recap, we have the victims, Angelique Badeau and Livia Somdi. We have a possible criminal activity, fake IDs, which still feels small potatoes to me. Thousands a month versus the hundreds of thousands that can be netted through drugs. So, who would be into something like that and have enough incentive to kidnap and hold two teenage girls for nearly a year?
What about this brother? Not Johnson, the other Somdi brother who appeared at the rec center.
The tall, sinister guy?
Lotham shrugs.
I'll do some asking around. Chances are the gang task force has a name.
I saw him.
You saw him?
The first time I visited Boston Academy. Skinny black dude, with a fashion sense that's at least 20 years out of date. I'd just wrapped up talking to Kira and Marjorie when I spotted him across the street.
He was watching me.
Lotham turns in the driver's seat, his shoulders massive in the confined space.
And you were going to mention this when?
What was there to mention? I was at a public school in Roxbury and a black guy stood across the street.